I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. There are many delightful and surprising anecdotes in Stephen Johnson's new book, Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World. One intriguing story involved Jacques de Vaucanson. He was a skilled 18th century automaton designer who built a flute-playing shepherd and a, quote, digesting duck that entertained passersby on the streets of Paris. That invention led Vaucanson to the idea of a loom programmed to create intricate silk patterns using cylinders. Well, that had big problems, but it inspired another Frenchman, Joseph-Marie Jacquard, who designed a successful loom that transformed textile production. Johnson's book is how the delight and wonder of play and entertainment have led to unexpected innovations and technologies that have shaped our world. His previous books include Where Good Ideas Come From, Future Perfect, Everything Bad is Good for You, How We Got to Now, which was developed into a PBS series which he hosted and co-created. And Stephen Johnson joins us from the NPR studios in New York City, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, it's great to be back. I'm glad you started with the digesting duck. That's always a good place to begin.
I could not resist, to tell you the truth. But let's talk a little bit about play. And I have to say, as I was reading your book, I was thinking about when our son was little and kids play. I mean, in many ways, little kids are scientists, they're explorers, they're philosophers. They know how to play like nobody else. When you talk about play, is that how you think about it?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that are worth saying. First off, in the book, the word play and the concept I'm talking about is slightly larger, I would say, than the traditional sense of kind of child's play or right. game play. That is certainly part of it, and there's a whole chapter on the history of games. The broader definition is things that we don't have to do, but that we do because they're fun or delightful or surprising or amusing in some way. So games are a great example of that, but so is fashion, for instance, or so are optical illusions. They aren't functional in some clear way. They don't give us, you know, they don't protect us against predators or against disease or, you know, directly help us reproduce our species. You know, they're just these kind of frills. And so I put all of that under, I wanted to have a single word to describe that. And that word became play because that was really, I thought, the most evocative one. But it does include a couple of other things. But that childhood instinct for play is very important because it shows that this appetite for kind of delight and kind of the playful exploration is a profound part of who we are as a species. And in fact, there seems to be a lot of evidence that animals that display a lot of play-like behavior in early childhood tend to be, when they grow up, the most kind of resilient, adaptive, creative, problem-solving species. And human beings just have the longest kind of childhood playtime of any animals. And so there seems to be a connection between creativity, imagination, and play that is borne out by the kind of historical studies that I look at in the book.
Well, let's go back to Baghdad. Let's go back to the 18th century. There were these three brothers known as Banu Musa, and they wrote a book called The Book of Ingenious Devices. I mean, a fascinating description, I guess, of the playthings of the time or how they thought about invention and play.
Yeah, 8th century, not 18th century. So we're going
8th century, absolutely.
Yeah. We're going back almost
way back,
you know, 1,200 years. And this is really at the height of the Islamic Golden Age. And Baghdad at this point is arguably the most advanced city in the world, certainly the seat of some of the most advanced scholarship in the world. And there's this, as you say, kind of amazing institution there called the House of Wisdom, which I think is a great name for an institution. And it was kind of like a little bit of a think tank and a translation bureau. But it was also, I guess we would call it now almost like a maker lab. And it was filled with these interesting engineers who were kind of designing, you know, cool objects using the most advanced technology of the day. And there were a number of them, but there were these three brothers that are now known as the Banu Musa. And they published a number of books illustrating their inventions. And these inventions involved absolutely state-of-the-art engineering techniques. So they had water clocks that were more accurate than anything Europe would see for hundreds of years. They were flow regulators that we now would use in kind of hydraulic systems. There was a float valves and all these, you know, kind of complicated engineering techniques or devices. But if you look at what they were actually building using all this advanced technology, almost all of it was toys.
Yeah.
There was you know, a little robotic peacock that you could kind of pull on its feathers and it would give you water, and the little man would pop out and give you a little bit of soap. Or there was an elephant clock, and there were little fountains that would spout water and rhythm, and there were lots of musical toys. And so you had this interesting thing, and you can see that their diagrams, beautiful full color diagrams that we reproduced in the book. And you see this interesting combination of some of the most advanced engineering in the world at that point, all in the service of toys.
Well, it's interesting.
And that was very kind of telling and that's actually kind of the opening scene in a sense of the book.
It absolutely is. And there are certain themes here. The music box begets, you know, other inventions that begets other inventions. And if you follow the path that you have laid, leads in many ways to the computers that we use today.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing that the book, this is what I've started doing.
It's a big sprawling book, I should say, but go ahead.
Well, you know, this is something like how, yeah, that's right. You were giving a spoiler alert where this is all
here
going.
We go.
No. This is the fun of these books. How we got to Now, the last one was like this too, where you kind of follow, you start somewhere and then you know, 10 pages later, you end up with something that seems totally different, but you know, it turns out there's a direct causal link between them. And so one of the other things that the Banu Musa did in Baghdad is they invented this device, which we almost lost record of, actually. We only found a manuscript describing it about 100 years ago. It almost kind of disappeared. But they invented this device called the instrument that plays itself. And it was basically an automated flute player that was kind of behind the scenes. It was really an organ. But you could take this little robot that would make it look like he was playing a flute. But what made this device so radical is that you could control the notes that were played by the organ using this rotating metallic cylinder, which you alluded to in the opening. And basically, it looked like a music box in the sense that you had little pins on the cylinder that corresponded to the notes that you wanted to play and the length of the notes that you wanted to play. But the radical idea was you could take out that cylinder and create a new one with a different set of notes and put it back in the machine, and it would play a completely different song. And the Banu Musa were very proud of this innovation, and they spent a lot of time in the description of it describing how you could cut a new cylinder if you wanted to create a new song. And what this really meant was this was arguably the first programmable machine in the history of the world. It was the first machine that wasn't just designed to do one thing but was open-ended in what it could do. And if you wanted to create some new function for it, you just created new code and inserted the code in the machine, and it would behave in this kind of new fashion. And that is really the beginning between hardware and software. The whole idea of programmability comes out of this creation. But it was not functional. It was a toy. It was music. And that stays alive, basically, in the world of music. That radical idea of programmability stays alive in music through music boxes, makes it all the way to Vaucanson, as you said, who started to think about it in terms of looms and textile production. It gets modified by Jacquard, as you said. And Jacquard's big idea was that you could program not with these cylinders but with paper punched cards. Mm. This was the big breakthrough, because a cylinder was too repetitive. It was just a circle. And so the patterns were very simple. But a stack of cards, you could just have an infinite number of patterns. And it was much easier to kind of repunch them and create a new code. And the punch card, one, was very important for textile production, but that was what inspired the first generation of computer designers. And in fact, punch cards were used to program computers up until the 1970s. I mean, I'm old enough to remember.
Me too.
You know, as a second grader in our school, we got a computer and there were these little punch cards.
Right.
And so there is a direct connection between these Baghdad engineers dreaming up this, you know, automated flute player and the modern computer. And I think that's kind of – it's important to remember this, because so often we think of the story of computers as being, oh, we got computers because we had to win World War II and we had to crack the Enigma code and we had to calculate rocket trajectories. And so it took a big military, you know, engagement to get us to think about code and computation in this way, which is a huge part of the story. I mean, I'm not denying that that was not important. But there's also this creative and musical and playful side to that story that – is just as important.
Stephen, let me quote you. You write in your book, you will find the future wherever people are having the most fun. You stand by that?
I do. Ironically, I should confess that that's the one line my editor was writing kind of jacket description for the book, and she kind of came up with a line for the jacket description, and I was like, that's a great line, Courtney. So I took it and
you
put it into the
and
book.
Stole it. Yes.
And now it's like the line everybody quotes. So, you know, whatever. I should just hand over the reins entirely to Courtney
right.
Young.
But
this is the thing. If think about it. If you were sitting there in 1750 trying to figure out what were the big changes coming to society over the next 200 years from automation and industrialization and computation computers and maybe even artificial intelligence and robots and all this big stuff that was coming, the best clue to that future would have been that digesting duck in Paris, you know, and this little automaton that was pretending to be alive and that was programmable and all these different things that we've talked about over the course of this hour. And that is often the case when we look at the same thing with Baghdad. If we went to the House of Wisdom, we would have seen a lot of the future there, but it would have looked like toys. It would have looked like amusement. And so when we're trying to figure out what's coming next, oftentimes what people are doing at the edge of their experiences in a non-directly functional way, but in a kind of amusement or kind of delight-driven way, that ends up being the seeds of more kind of serious revolutions to come.
I was thinking when we got our call about she was focusing on the workplace, but one has to think about schools that get rid of recess or are removing gym classes or art classes. I mean, some of it is because of financial problems or the lack of finances, but it does seem giving up all that stuff, we're going to pay a big price for that.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I think, you know, the big push on to STEM education, I think that the STEAM modification of STEM where there's arts in there is, I think, a useful corrective. Just thinking about music alone in this story, how important it is. So I'm trying to remind people that, you know, there is a playful, creative, imaginative, artistic side to science, technology, engineering, and math. And in the long run, if we lose that playfulness, we'll suffer. Mm-hmm.
So where today are most people having the most fun?
Well, look, a great example of this really happened after I'd finished the draft of the book, which was Pokemon Go last summer. You know, there we have this, you know, the first real kind of augmented reality experience where people are walking around the world getting information from their computer that's added onto a screen that's showing them the real world supplemented with this other information. And they were doing it to capture imaginary monsters or whatever the Pokemon are.
I never quite figured that out, but yes, go ahead.
But it was amazing. It was great for our family because our kids just wanted to go run around all day long and explore our little town where we live in the summer, which they never want to do. So got them outside. But that, I think, we'll look back 10 years from now as we're, you know, when we all have devices that are kind of doing that for us all the time through glasses or whatever we're wearing, and we'll say, oh, this started with a game.
Well, Stephen Johnson, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. You've no doubt noticed that when you are shopping online, you're being followed by ads for the products or services that you have clicked. Well, it turns out that similar things are happening in the grocery and department stores you frequent through your smartphone, sending you targeted ads and through surveillance cameras tracking your movements. Brick and mortar stores have been taking a page from digital marketers to stay competitive. Our guest, Joseph Turow, has concerns about the impact of these tools on our privacy and the potential for discrimination. His book is titled The Aisles Have Eyes, and he's the Robert Louis Cheyenne Professor of Communication and Associate Dean for Graduate Studies at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. It's a long title there. And Joe, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let's begin with the most obvious, which is that when we are shopping online, it's clear that some digital cookie, I guess, is following us around. How much information do these, let's say, department stores or other stores have on us specifically?
They actually have a lot. They can get the material by following you on the site. They can also track you off-site using other technologies. And they sometimes, more and more buy stuff about you from companies that have collected data online and offline. More and more, too, they've begun to combine offline data with online data.
So do they know, I mean, all of our kind of food preferences or entertainment preferences or what we like to buy and shop?
They could. There are some data brokers that have thousands of bits of information. Facebook, Google, Amazon have a lot of information. Other places don't have that many. And it depends on how sophisticated they are. We're just in the beginning of this era. It's amazing to think that the commercial internet's only about 20 years old. Yeah. And so things are sort of happening. A lot of what we'll be talking about today are just at the takeoff point.
Do they know more than the NSA knows about us?
About us, about individuals, perhaps. About you and me, maybe. I don't know.
It is a kind of creepy convenience. I mean, I think most of us do some shopping online, and it is weird. You go someplace, you look at something, and then you go somewhere else. And next thing you know, you're being followed by an image or a word or something. And it's a little unsettling, I have to say.
What's called retargeting or remarketing is the most common way of getting people who've been at a site. And oftentimes, companies are still so siloed that if you buy something over the phone, but you looked at it online, it'll still follow you. Which is, marketers would say that's a bad thing because you've already bought it.
Right.
I bought something recently over the phone, and I've been getting every day from a whole lot of places images of that product. What's interesting, though, is the reach of that marketer. I mean, they literally follow me everywhere I go online to show me an ad for that particular product.
I do want to talk about what's happening in the stores, which mm-hmm. is essentially what your book is about. And you say there was a real turning point for a number of department stores, retailers, where Amazon told people to go scan prices with their smartphone and they would beat those prices.
Yeah, that was in 2011. Pretty amazing, gutsy thing for them to do. What they did is exactly, they told people to go into the store, they would get a discount if they bought the product. But more importantly for Amazon, they were getting a list of how much everything was costing across the United States. So it was like research for them. It drove merchants crazy, the brick and mortar people. Target stopped accepting the selling some stuff that they had from Amazon. But gradually they began to say, we have to do something about this because otherwise we're going to have terrible problems.
Well, in fact, you say it's really through our smartphone that a lot of this activity takes place. How does that work?
Well, in many different ways, but the smartphone has become a marketing device. It's the major marketing. People sleep with their smartphones. It is a personal device that is unlike anything else. And so what companies do is they try to get you. There's a number of ways. They can track you anonymously in the beginning by Wi-Fi if they want, by tying into your Wi-Fi if you have it on in the store. Then they can try to relate the ID of your phone to who you are if that works. If you have an app of one sort, either an app of the store or an app that relates to the store, and they have what's called Bluetooth boxes around the store, they can track you as you walk through the store and, for all intents and purposes, change the prices based upon the history that they have about you by sending you discount coupons as you're walking around the store. There are other ways that companies are using now. For example, Walmart has been trying using lighting from General Electric, and Philips has a technology too, which can actually use your phone's camera to figure out where you are in the store and track you, in addition to Bluetooth-related materials.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things just to underscore what you said. And I guess our smartphone, as you write in this book, is not really a phone at all. It really is. How many times do we actually, I think a lot of people text and email. Mm-hmm. That's how they use their phone, but probably don't use it
as
we would think of as a phone.
And younger people, too, far more do text messages than actual phone. The phone part of the smartphone has become a commodity. And in many cases, when you buy a contract, they practically give you the phone messages, the actual phoning. The rest of it is data is what you're paying for.
And you mentioned the fact that there can be different prices depending on who the person is. I mean, it's sort of like the airlines, right? You can sit next to someone in a seat on an airline and find out they paid either maybe half as much or maybe twice as much.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is you never see a revolt about that. I mean, when people are sitting in front of the gate, they're not going to say when people say zone 2 or zone 4, they say, hey, I paid X amount of money for this. Why am I in zone 4? People don't discuss it. And when I spoke to people in the industry about this whole idea of differential pricing, it's only beginning to take off, and some companies are still uncomfortable with it because they feel that people are angry about it, perhaps. Ultimately, they think that people will accept it because it will be on their private phones. Huh. They won't know what other people are paying. And so they're hoping that by making it personalized to the extreme, they might be able to get away with different prices. And sometimes it's even higher prices rather than lower prices.
Which is interesting. Sometimes the sort of favored shopper ends up paying the higher price.
Yeah.
Why would that
right be? Now that's happening more online. But the reason is that they figure since you're a constant customer, they don't have to give you a better price. One company told me, and I promised I wouldn't tell the name, that they actually will give people that they perceive are moving away from them lower prices than people that they know are constant customers.
In fact, there, and I don't know whether this exists today or we're talking about the future, but even sort of lingering technology. So if you're in front of a row of, let's say, shoes, and if you're lingering there, somebody knows or some technology knows
absolutely.
You were doing
that.
Absolutely.
With the Bluetooth, they can do that. They can look at how long you were there. What's really just beginning to happen now is, let's say you're standing in front of shoes, and then you leave the store.
Right.
A company can track you as you walk outside and follow you with these remarketing ads. Down the line, and this is a bit controversial, but down the line they can see if you went to another shoe store. And as you're near that shoe store, they can send you a text message telling you to go back. That's called geo-conquesting, where a company will look at where you are outside as you're moving toward a competitor and send you a message to try to get you to go to them.
You know, I was thinking as you were describing that, if this were a person who was telling us this information versus a piece of technology that we're getting through our phone, there might be much more negative reaction. Our feeling is if you're being stalked almost.
It is like stalking, and I think what it is people don't know about it. My sense of the word creepy, which I use and lots of people use, I've heard it used in the Senate even, creepy essentially means we find it uncomfortable, but we really don't understand it. And I think that part of what's happening based on surveys I've done over the years of the American public, we do these national surveys, people understand they're being tracked, but they have no clue exactly how it works. They're nervous about it. But and in a last survey about a year and a half ago, what we really found was that people are resigned, that 58% of Americans, if you ask them about two statements, which we put in the survey in different ways, one, I would like to make sure that companies don't follow me online. And the other is, I've come to believe that I have no way really of escaping what companies do online or something like that. Again, scattered through the questionnaire, 58% of Americans agreed with both of those, which we said is kind of a resigned attitude.
Well, in fact, you call it the privacy paradox, right?
It is. And marketers say the paradox is people supposedly give up information all the time just for a little bit of discounts. But then they say they're nervous about it. So marketers will say that's because they have this logical cost-benefit analysis. What we're arguing through the survey findings, it's really not a cost-benefit analysis. It's I just can't do anything about it. Hmm. I have to be on Facebook. All my friends are on Facebook. And anecdotally, even before we did the survey, I hear this from everybody I know. There's no alternative. What are you going to do, not go to Amazon? You know?
Let me hang that out there. And that's Joseph Turow. And his book is called The Aisles Have Eyes, subtitled How Retailers Track Your Shopping, Strip Your Privacy, and Define Your Power. And we're talking about something that we all do, whether shopping online or shopping in department stores or grocery stores. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You write about Nordstrom's actually a while ago put up a sign saying you are being watched, basically saying there are cameras in the store and they are watching you. What was the consumer response?
Real negative. Even in that case, though, it was simply watching them without totally anonymous. People got very upset and Nordstrom's took the monitoring off. They said it was an experiment. It shows how people instinctively get very concerned about this stuff. And yet we don't make the same connection when we're with our phones. Again, it may be because of the personal nature of the phone. But Nordstrom was very concerned, and they just didn't want the bad publicity, so they took it away.
But in a way, has the phone become the surveillance camera?
Absolutely. But there are also cameras. There are cameras that right now in the United States pretty well differentiate you by gender. They look at how many people are passing. At this point, we're not at the point where in many, many stores they know who you are. There are cameras, however, that are set up to figure out the faces of shoplifters. And there's a company, I spoke to somebody from a company that does this. They actually load, they have the ability to tell the retailer if a person who's a known shoplifter has walked into the store, and then they can usher them out. That's a problem in some areas, because if a person has had that experience, all of a sudden the person's a criminal in the eyes of the camera. So in some communities, that may be a really difficult issue. But that is one possible direction that we're moving in.
You talk about, I guess, the kind of profiling that can go on and customers, in a sense, rated for what if they're how much money they spend or perhaps where they live.
They're scoring.
Yes. So how does that work?
Yeah, well, if anyone has ever heard of the site called Clout, which isn't as popular maybe anymore, what they would do is rank you based upon how much conversation about you there is on Twitter and stuff. This is a little like that, except that it's also based upon your income, your shopping habits, and what's called whether you're a high-value customer. Hmm. And the retailer, one retailer may think of you differently from another retailer, but what they'll do is they will give you a number. And that number will help determine the kind of discounts you get, whether they want you to come. Some retailers actually don't want people to show up in their store because they tend to buy too many things that are on bargains. And as a result, there's very low margin. So they don't really want those people around. They're not going to fire them. I spoke to one person from a supermarket and said, we don't fire these people. We try to move them up to buying other things. Hmm. There are some retailers who may say, we just want to push these people away. Some banks, by the way, and I've never figured out exactly which ones, will triage callers when you call their number, their 800 number, whatever, based upon your score. If you're somebody they really care about, they will answer the phone quicker than someone else.
So data can lead to discrimination?
Yes. There's another thing which apparently has only recently been talked about. I think it's fairly new, where there are companies that actually have call centers that match the call person that answers your phone with data they have about you, with the notion that that kind of discrimination can lead to a better sale if the person is like you, whatever that means.
Hmm. I mean, how would one know that?
It's all a construction.
With an anonymous person.
Well, they're not anonymous. They know by the phone number that you're calling from who you are based on previous calls.
Let me get some callers in. We've got Lee from, looks like, Wynwood joining our conversation. Hi, Lee. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I agree that there's a lot of possibility for discrimination, but I thought sometimes retailers can take the power back a little bit by going online, putting some stuff in your online shopping bag, and then not purchasing. And then what I've found is that the company then often sends me coupons because they know that I've looked at things and haven't bought, and I can go back and get them for a better deal.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's smart, actually. Yeah. And people are trying to do those sorts of resistances. There's another related thing to that, which is a wallet on your phone. It is possible, and I only found this in my research, for companies to get you to get something, for example, through a text message. It's a discount. You click on that. It goes into your phone wallet. When you go into the store, you can either remember it or it remind you, and then you can buy it. If you don't use that coupon, the company can go in and change the price over time while it's in your phone. So if you wait longer, you may get a better discount. People try to do exactly what you're saying, and it's a way to try to win. There are going to be winners and losers in all this system.
But that obviously takes – and Lee, I appreciate the call to Radio Times – takes a couple of steps on her part in order to game the system.
It's quite
savvy. She sees it.
Yeah.
But I also got the feeling reading your book that that coupons and loyalty programs, I mean, that's a way of obviously encouraging people to make specific purchases or to go to a specific store, but it's also the way that they get information on us.
Exactly.
Right?
Loyalty programs used to be just for that, loyalty. I don't know how many people remember green stamps, which was the
idea. I remember green stamps.
You went ahead and you licked a stamp based upon things you bought in a store, and it was a number of stores. And then you got these booklets based on the licking and went to a place and got cameras or whatever. That was to encourage loyalty. Today, loyalty programs do some of that, but the main reason for loyalty programs are data. They get data about you. And everything that you do with your frequent shopper card is another piece of data that the company has about you. Supermarkets are great at that.
Well, let's talk about barcodes, which has some interesting history, including a little bit of history here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, the barcode. I found out about the importance of the barcode. Everyone is familiar, I suppose, with the barcode. It's on everything, including the book. But the barcode is a product of two graduate students at Drexel University in the late 1940s. They overheard a supermarket executive talking to a dean saying he wished there were ways to better keep track of the products. They went around within a couple of months, had created something which is very much like today's barcode system. But it took until the 1970s for companies to figure out how to use it, partly because the computerization made it easier, but partly because they just didn't have a reason. When in the early 70s, it was huge inflation, supermarkets decided they needed to track this stuff, the barcode was instituted. The barcode is a predecessor to the idea of being able to track everything you do, and it's probably one of the most important inventions of the 20th century, started at Drexel.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Joseph Turow, and the book is called The Aisles Have Eyes, How Retailers Track Your Shopping, Strip Your Privacy, and Define Your Power. 1-888-477-9499, the number to call to join our conversation. Lots of comments here, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskow-Wayne talking with Joseph Turow, and he's a professor of communication, associate dean for graduate studies at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia. We are talking about surveillance and our smartphones and what it's like to shop when we are being watched. Let me read a tweet from Dan. He says, what's the total impact of this on sales, given that brick and mortar are caving to online shopping? Macy's, as we know, just laid off a whole bunch of people. Who's sort of winning this online?
It's really interesting. We may be in a kind of situation where incrementally people are moving away from the brick and mortar. But if you look at the numbers, last year it was 90% of shopping revenues still come from brick and mortar. It may be gone down a bit. Supposedly in Christmas, 20% of all shopping was actually purchasing was done online.
Right.
A lot of it went to Amazon. So that what's happening is that the big gorilla in the room is taking a lot of that stuff, not the margins. But more and more people are buying stuff online. They're feeling more comfortable with that. Typically, still, people are buying off their desktop, laptop, or tablets, not so much their phones. But even that, more and more people are moving to being comfortable by buying from phones themselves.
And how important is customer service? I mean, making the customer feel comfortable with their either purchases or their shopping experience.
You know what's interesting? A lot of the brick-and-mortar stores feel that the experience is what's going to save them. And yet, there's some research that says that a significant percentage of people don't even want to deal with real people.
Really?
They want to deal with either computers, chatbots, or simply figure out what they need and get out. Amazon is testing a store now in Seattle, which is sort of the extreme of what I talk about in the book. It's totally checkout without checking out. You don't go through any checkout. You simply walk into the store, register with your smartphone, go pick up what you want, and supposedly they track every second of what you do. Put the stuff in a bag, walk out of the store, and you're automatically charged.
Wow. You think that's the future?
They claim it is. There have been other attempts to try to get people to check out without checking out. Walmart has tried other kinds of things based on scanning, for example. Retailers say that the problem with that is that you never get to speak to anybody in the store. Mm-hmm. It used to be said that the checkout experience was the one time that you got to see the face of the store through the store staff. Now it'll simply be sort of robotic. Everything is happening via your phone and your store. That may be the future, but there is this very strong sense that people just want to get out, you know?
You tell a story in here. It's one I think we all know about. Is it the frog? The frog in the water that slowly gets heated up and it doesn't realize it's being boiled to death. Yeah. But is that sort of the world that we're in?
Well, I actually heard that being used as a metaphor in a conference, an industry conference I went to. The man was saying, we want to do this tracking stuff. We want to do this figuring out what people are like stuff without getting people too alarmed. And he said, you got to make them like the frog in boiling water. We have to reach the point of getting them to buy this stuff without getting to see when it's happening.
You also make an interesting point, especially where there's different prices for different people for the same product, that it's the way peddlers would size up their customers, yeah. You know, of 100 or more years ago.
Yeah, if you look at the history of retailing, we tend to accept the 20th century idea of what retailing in America is about. Before the 1850s or so, peddlers and small merchants would sell stuff based upon a price they would bargain with someone and their stereotype of who that person is. In the 20th century, things changed because of the growth of department stores. Philly had a lot to do with this too, by the way. Quakers believed that it is sinful to charge different people different prices. And also when department stores like Wanamaker and A.T. Stewart in New York got started, the sense was, I don't want to teach my clerks how to bargain. Right. So posted prices became the thing. And the kind of democratic ideal of the store, you saw everything supposedly, everybody paid the same price. It wasn't totally true, and a lot of discrimination, particularly among African-American neighborhoods and stuff like that. But that was the ideal. The argument in this book is we're moving kind of back to the future, that we're moving into a peddler kind of mentality where the price you see and even the products you see will not be based on what everybody else sees, but rather a sense, a scientific, in quotes, sense of who you are, when you will buy, and what you will buy.
But if it leads to some form of discrimination, and one could see how that would happen, would it make it illegal at some point in the future to have a different price for you than a different price for me?
Right now, and for many years, that is certainly not illegal. Some economists say that differential pricing is a good thing. The idea of charging one person a different price compared to another is not illegal.
Let me read another comment, then we'll get back to our callers. An email from Christine: do our smartphones listen to us without our knowledge?
That has happened. There are ways to do it. It is something that you have to be careful. You can turn off your microphone. Mainly it's through malware. There was a situation where I believe Samsung television sets were doing that kind of thing. Hmm. But it is technically possible. And I'm sure the NSA and the CIA do this all the time.
Let me get Charles from Southwest Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Charles. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
I just want to ask your guest, one, is the apps that are on the phones, I noticed when I try to get on some of them, they have a litany of things they want to get access to in order to serve you. And I noticed that's increased over time. And also, do the phones themselves, as they've morphed and grown more advanced, and why they always have new phones all the time, is that part of this what I consider an insidious little plot to to take over us?
Well, I think you're right about the complexity of the phone as sort of growing with the ability to sell stuff to you and to show you different things. You're absolutely right. Companies, apps will try to access different parts of your phone, sometimes because it relates to what they're doing. But a lot of times, and this is particularly with location, They want to do it because they want to sell your location to other companies. If you've ever tried to download an app or had an app say, can we look at your location? And you say to yourself, why do they need my location? What's really going on there is they are selling your location to an advertising network. And at that point, advertisers can literally buy you in a particular place and send an ad to you at that moment. So what you're doing is you're offering yourself to an ad network when you do that. There are companies that will oftentimes have free apps. Free apps means that somebody is taking your data in some way. That's what's free about it. And a lot of times it's because they sell your data for a location marketing project.
So what do you do if you want to prevent this? I mean, most of us have a mobile device that we use.
Well, what you can do is say no. For example, with Google Maps, just say that you only want to use it when you're using the maps. Sometimes
you're saying just say no?
Yeah, just say no, right. It's easier said than done with a lot of other things. People don't read the privacy policies. I can't blame them. But the privacy policies will tell you things that will get you very angry when you realize what companies do with your data.
Such as?
Well, they sell stuff. They buy data about you from other companies. They will track you as you walk around, as we said, with the stores. Those kinds of things can add up. And in the end, they will charge you different prices or show you different messages based upon who you are.
Let me get back to our callers. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments as well. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Dan from Philadelphia to join us. Charles, thanks for the call. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. This is a great discussion, and
thank
also reminds me of the discussion that you had been having a couple months back on predictive policing. And my question was actually a few now, but first about discrimination, because I know that some payday loan outfits have been using predictive modeling to try and target consumers who would be more likely to default on loans and try and wrap them in. Have there been any lawsuits against this on a basis of privacy or discrimination? And then a follow-up question I had about small vendors. Do small vendors use this at all, or is there any opportunity, or is this something that only really large outlets can use, like Amazon or Walmart and so forth?
Yeah,
and I'll take my call off the air. Thank you.
You're welcome, Dan. Thanks.
These are great questions. Thank you. As I said, it is totally legal to do price discrimination in the United States. I don't know of any suits on that. There have been suits of Facebook and other companies for taking people's data without their permission, particularly when Facebook will track people who are not Facebook members, and Google too. For example, if you sent Gmail to someone, there have been situations where Gmail will track what the person to whom you sent it is or says.
Oh,
and
wow.
They're not into that. They don't want that. They haven't approved it through the privacy policy, and there have been suits in that direction. But in general, in terms of following you around, that's just not been an issue at this point, unless you're underage, which is a whole other issue, under 13. In terms of discriminatory activities, you're absolutely right. The profiling is part of this new world that we live in. The world we live in increasingly is personalized, and it's from science in the biological sense, DNA. You can get your DNA and find the personalized ancestry, and as you pointed out, payday loans, personalization. As I was coming to the studio today, I got a phone call from a payday loan company.
Did you really?
And they said, you asked us for a payday. It was a recording, of course. You asked us about payday loans. Push a button if you want to get one. I never asked them, but they just figured they'd spam everybody. Discrimination is the nature of the activity, and then we have to ask, is it prejudicial discrimination toward the person or another person, and what are the implications of that?
Let me read another comment, and this is from Agnes, sort of a follow-up what we were talking about. In order for someone to track your location, you would need to have your phone's location turned on. Mm-hmm. If you keep it off, how can you be tracked?
You can shut it off and you won't be tracked. You can shut all your apps off walking into a store and you won't be tracked. You can shut your Wi-Fi off and you won't be tracked. You can do all of those things. And I think people do. Now, the way companies try to get around that is to say, hey, free Wi-Fi, because people have data plans and they don't want to waste their money. So free Wi-Fi means the company can figure out what your phone ID is. And if you want discounts, and who doesn't, put your app on. If you want to go into Target and you want Cartwheel, the Cartwheel app, put your app on. So there are blandishments that companies give us to try to make us feel comfortable about this.
And what do you do? I mean, this is an issue you have been writing about and exploring for years now.
And I'm very, very nervous about giving up data. And I will say no to a lot of the things people have just said about location and all this kind of stuff. But to be honest, when I go into a Starbucks and I want free Wi-Fi, I will get on Starbucks. I never buy anything through that public kind of Wi-Fi. I have to admit that in some sense, I'm a resignation person. I'm a little resigned to it. We're living in a certain world. It's hard to totally deny that. But it gets me angry. And the question then becomes, what do we do? I think part of the issue is that companies want us to be resigned rather than to be angry. And that's an issue moving forward in our century. This is not something that's going to go away in 2 years.
And I guess the question is, because on the other hand, I mean, to have access to the world of information, who wants to give that up? And whether we can protect our privacy more, or at least be more knowledgeable about protecting our privacy, but also have access to this world of ideas.
And I know people who will say they do not have a frequent shopper card, for example, in a supermarket, on principle. Problem is, of course, you're losing about 20% to 25% of the price, because that helps you get goods at cheaper. I remember in California once I went into a Ralph's. I was visiting Santa Barbara to give a talk there, and I wanted to get a 2-liter Coke bottle, and it was $1 off, but they wouldn't give it to me because I didn't have a Ralph's card. Now, in some of the stores around here, they'll give it to you anyway. But out there, the guy was obdurate. I had to pay the full price.
Well, looking into the future, and in many ways, it sounds like we're sort of half talking about the future. Things like body scans or retinal scans, body implants, digital clothing. Yeah. How close are all of this?
What I say in the book, and it was astonishing to me, I was at a conference, an industry conference about a year and a half ago, and a guy from a major consultancy firm was talking about his prediction that by 2028, 50% of Americans will have implants in their arms, which will tell retailers whether they're nervous about a particular price, so the retailer can contact their phone and lower the price based upon their body frequencies and what changes in their body. What was interesting was not just what he said, but the 50 or so people in the room, nobody raised their hand, nobody laughed, nobody questioned it. And he argued that by the 2050s, everyone in the United States would have some kind of implant like this.
You think that's true?
No. but, you know, I think what was happening was the people in that room are so concerned and so confused about the nature of our reality. I do think it's true that we're going to be moving from passwords to biometrics. I think more and more we'll see thumbprint password ways to get in. Retinal scans will become more important. People will be encouraged to do this as a way for security. And, of course, security is a big deal. But once you get a person to do retinal scans, then you know it's that particular individual, not just a household person.
Well, to be continued, Joe Turow, thank you for joining us today.
My
in
pleasure.
Radio Times.
Great.
Professor of Communications, Associate Dean for Graduate Studies at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. The book is The Aisles Have Eyes, How Retailers Track Your Shopping, Strip Your Privacy, and Define Your Power. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Artie Moscowing. Thanks for joining us.